There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Thursday, January the 9th.
Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
But we begin with a big global newsmaker in business over the past 24 hours, who is Brandy Scott.
Kristalina Georgieva.
Didn't see that one coming from the left field, but I'll give it to you.
Well, funnily enough, from the left is exactly kind of what I am saying this morning. Blog written by the new IMF managing director saying that the IMF needs to tackle inequality. Everyone needs to tackle inequality, and she'd like to see higher tax on the rich.
To be fair, the rich have said something similar. We heard from Bill Gates just a few days ago saying, it's ridiculous how little tax I pay, ditto Warren Buffett. But how is she defining the rich? Clearly, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, the world's richest people. But I guess by most normal standards, you and I would be considered the rich, wouldn't we?
Do you know what? There's not a plan that's been laid out here. This is a blog post. She says it's basically, I would take it as the first step from the IMF in this direction. Because, of course, 1990s IMF, free market, I mean, that's generally been the way of the IMF once upon a time, tax-cutting approach. Then also,
yeah, I mean, market-based reforms, the Washington Consensus, they have been considered.
Yes.
Basically a bastion of the kind of, you know, Reaganite, Thatcherite, supply-side economics.
And, you know, and the other piece of, I say advice, and I'm saying that in inverted commas, that the IMF often insists on with rescue packages for countries is cutting a lot of spending, often social spending, and social spending obviously now recognised as being important to narrow that income gap, to do away with inequality. So I picked it up this morning because I thought it was a bit of a very marked sea change for the IMF, the fact that the new chief has kind of flown a colours up the flagpole, if you like. She's let us know where she stands. She says the IMF can't do alone, that they need to do it with countries, civil society, the private sector and international organisations. But she thinks it needs to happen.
What do we think about this? You think it's a good idea? It's a bad idea?
Oh, it's one of those things. Everyone thinks that the rich should pay more tax until they start moving up the ladder.
And it's the definition of rich. Everyone knows that Mark Zuckerberg is rich. And everyone knows the definition of poor. I mean, the World Bank says below $1.90 a day. But I mean, that is extreme poverty. But, you know, the middle class consider themselves middle class and therefore shouldn't be taxed. But to the, you know, the those people living below $1.90 a day, the middle class, like you and I, are rich as Croesus.
But I think that there absolutely needs to be a rethink of it. I think Bill Gates is right. And I think particularly on the corporation tax as well, which is the other big one, of course, that gets people riled, and rightly so. She's not my only newsmaker this morning, though. I'm going to be greedy and I'm going to have two.
It's the weekend. Fill your boots.
Because Carlos Ghosn.
Who is rich?
Massive press conference last night. Everyone was waiting for it. It was, by all accounts, a spectacle. It went on for hours.
You've likened it to what?
It was, I don't know, what did
was
I,
it a sporting event or theatre?
Oh, you know, it was a sporting event. I mean, people were commentating. I was glued to the FT. There were live blog updates. They had three people there blogging and updating the website. And every time it refreshed, it was like, the Olympics or a sporting fixture. It was fabulous. They started off by describing what he was wearing. He, you know, appears to have gone a little grey. He's wearing a pink tie. It was fabulous. But he just gave and gave and gave and gave and gave. And there is a question there about whether or not we should all be pouring, you know, we should be standing riveted to a man who has effectively fled a justice system. He says rightly, but that is one side, obviously, of the story. But the point is we are, and I suspect that partly it's because it's an awesome story and really good theatre. Is that wrong?
I'm absolutely fascinated by it, as is the world. By far the most read story in business newspapers, websites and everything else over the past 24 hours or so. We're going to hear from him now, Carlos Ghosn. We've got so many sound bites that we can pick, Brandy Scott. Which one do you want to go with first?
I want to hear how much it cost.
This is him talking after the press conference. He did some interviews. This is him talking to CNBC about the cost of his escape from Japan.
I've seen a lot of numbers circulating in the press. I think they are very, very generous in general.
Too high.
Yeah. So that's what I can tell you. I don't think you need this kind of money to be able to organize. Obviously, the simpler the it is, the better it is, the more chance you have to be successful, and the more discreet you'll be.
In this wide-ranging press conference, in which he took questions in several languages, he went into, you know, he hit out at his treatment in prison. He alleged collusion between Nissan and the prosecutor. He gave a couple of sort of business tips and scoops on the side about what was going on. I mean, at the beginning, you'd have loved it. He gave a schedule.
Really?
He was like, right, I'm going to break down, I mean, sort of 40, 50 minutes in, he said, I'm going to break down the rest of my remarks into these five sections.
Oh, excellent.
One, why this all happened. Two, how this happened. Three, the charges. Four, the state of the Renault-Nissan-Mitsubishi alliance. Five, the smear. Do you know what I mean? It was an event. One of the things, I mean, there are several things I find interesting. One of the things I find particularly interesting, and I imagine because there is an ongoing legal case against this man
and some.
Japan, that journalists who from the print media sitting there, obviously you've got this pressure to be first, which is why, you know, traditional publications like the FT are live blogging something like this. You know, the Financial Times. Whilst no doubt sitting there also on their mobiles messaging the company lawyers about what they can say and what they can't. And I notice that whilst the FT notes that Goen claimed that Nissan was plotting to oust him, they put plotting in inverted commas, they say he named the people who he believes were involved in this plot. They don't name the names.
That's interesting.
So, I mean, because you're sitting there, you want to be first, don't you? There's a guy from the Bloomberg to the left of you. You know, CNN's got their cameras. You know that Richard Quest has got an interview with Carlos Ghosn afterwards. No one wants to miss the scoop, but no one wants to get sued either.
My final newsmaker today, though, on a lighter note, is Khalid Ahmed Ali Al-Jalaf, who is a calligraphy artist and one of the inspiring 49 artists who helped design the three logos that were shortlisted for the logo of the UAE. And on Wednesday, after Seven Lines was announced as the winning logo, he talked about his pride in developing it. What do we make of the new logo? I think we can say...
We voted for it.
We all voted for Seven Lines.
Is this like declaring your political allegiance, which as a journalist you're not supposed to do? Although, to be fair, if anyone listens to us for 5 minutes, they could probably guess that anyway.
To be fair, yes, that is true. Yes.
We did all vote for it, and none of us colluded.
And it's the only time I've voted in 21 years of the UAE.
But, I mean, you know, we'd have Serena Kelly in here, we had Sanuja. Absolutely everyone was like, yeah, okay, I did. It was one of those standout winners, which is fantastic. The aim is that we want this to be as instantly recognisable as a red maple leaf or a silver fern, don't we?
It's got to be instant recognition in milliseconds, less than a second. You don't have to think about it, you just see it. And you recognise it. Khalid Al-Jalaf says the seven lines stand for our forefathers, our great leaders, the founders of the country. They also represent the seven emirates. His day job is head of the knowledge department at the Dubai Health Authority, but he is a well-known calligrapher.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We do, however, have full drama. Is Lebanon, that amazing 2.5-hour press conference by Carlos Ghosn yesterday, has captivated the world's attention. We are joined now on the line by Leila Malana Allen. She's the Middle East correspondent for France 24 in Beirut in Lebanon. Leila, it's lovely to speak to you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Dandy.
What is Lebanon making of all of this?
Oh, there's been great excitement here. So it's been a huge saga since Carlos Ghosn arrived on New Year's Eve in this very exciting, daring escape from Tokyo, in which he appears to have boarded the bullet train and then been smuggled out of the country in a box designed for musical instruments. And nobody knew he had arrived until after he'd already come through the airport and gone to his home in Beirut, where he then made a statement. So since then, that was on New Year's Eve, and since then, everybody's been waiting for him to emerge. I was standing outside the house all day yesterday, as yesterday was this big press conference he announced, which was going to be the first time that he sort of properly spoke publicly about this 14-month ordeal, he calls it, that he went through in Japan in jail and under house arrest.
How is he being treated on his return? Because we obviously have this massive attention around him. Some are treating him as a hero, but he himself has used the word fugitive.
So this is an interesting one because, of course, Carlos Ghosn has three nationalities, citizenships. He is originally Lebanese, so his parents were born in Lebanon and he spent some time in Lebanon growing up, so he was a citizen. He's also a French citizen and a Brazilian citizen, which is where he was born. So that's why there's been this sort of confusion about where he might go. But he's been a national hero in Lebanon for a long time. He's actually on a postage stamp. And so the older generation really does consider him like that, an entrepreneurial hero. He has great contacts in government. The foreign minister has constantly defended him and said that he's a great hero of the country and he must be supported and respected. When the charges were originally launched in Japan, the Lebanese government came forward and supported him, advocated for him and said that they did not believe this was true. So on the one hand, he has been welcomed back like that. And we know from sources inside the government that actually some politicians encouraged the Lebanese authorities to make sure that his entry to the airport was smooth and he was allowed to overcome some of those normal entry procedures in order to be able to get back into the country quickly and quietly. On the other hand, things have been changing in Lebanon recently because, of course, we've seen these protests, these anti-government protests over the last few months. And as a result, some of the younger generation are now saying this is just another very privileged elite person who is being allowed to play the system and is getting special treatment because they're so wealthy and they have all these contacts and he should face justice just like anyone else. So, and of course, he is a fugitive from justice because there is this outstanding Interpol red notice, which is a wanted notice on his name. So actually not the uniformly warm welcome to Lebanon that he might have expected a while ago.
So what happens next? Much has been made of the fact that there is no extradition treaty between Lebanon and Japan. Obviously, it's not just Lebanese-Japanese relations here. The French obviously have a stake in this as well. Where are the question marks and what could we see?
Absolutely, yes. So in a sort of another twist in this very dramatic story yesterday, in the middle of his press conference, while he was laying out his store and telling his long story about how he felt that the Japanese justice system was completely rigged and he had to get out of there because he would never get justice in Japan, at that moment, the Lebanese judiciary issued a summons for him to come today on Thursday and answer questions from judges. And what's happening here is that, as I said, there's been this Interpol red notice issued, which the Japanese asked Interpol to issue. What that is, it's not an arrest warrant, but it is a notice that notifies the Lebanese authorities that this man is wanted and asked for their help in getting him back for whatever purpose, whether in different countries, extradition or deportation, or to be tried in their own country. So as there isn't an extradition treaty between Lebanon and Japan, and the other thing is Lebanon rarely extradites its citizens. It's known for giving safe harbour to Lebanese citizens who are wanted in other countries, often because they are very wealthy and they kind of come back to Lebanon and contribute in Lebanon. So they do have a history of that. So extradition isn't what would happen. However, the Lebanese authorities can respond to this notice as they like. And what happens now is that in this judiciary hearing today, he will be questioned by judges. And if they find that what he did in Japan with this Netanyahu deal is a felony under Lebanese law, then they can arrest him and they have the option to send him back to Japan to deport him if they want to, or they can try him in Lebanon for the crimes. Now, he says that he's very open to that. He said yesterday, I couldn't get justice in Japan because of this rigged justice system he was talking about, that I need to seek it somewhere else and I will clear my name. So he says he would be happy to undergo trial in Lebanon. But of course, many people saying because of his great power and contacts in Lebanon, it's very unlikely that actually a conviction would be secured in this country And the reason he wants to go through that process is that he's more likely to get favourable treatment. So that's where we are next. He's not quite out of the woods yet.
We watch with bated breath, as does the world. Leila Milana Allen, Middle East correspondent for France 24, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon, where she has been one of the press holding the vigil outside Carlos Ghosn's residence. We appreciate your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
The UAE oil minister has been speaking in Abu Dhabi in the wake of yesterday's Iranian missile attacks on US bases in Iraq. We are joined on the line now by Sean Evers, founder and managing partner of Gulf Intelligence. They're the people behind the event. Sean, thanks for speaking to us. And it was your gig that the UAE Energy Minister Sahail Al-Mazrui was on stage at. We're just going to listen very quickly to some of his comments here.
The Strait of Hormuz is not only important for us, it's important for the world economy, and it's important to the whole supply chain, and Iran understand that. If that supply is cut, I can assure you every country in the world will be impacted. And the world economy cannot sustain another $100 oil prices and another huge spike.
And of course, it was a big day on the commodities markets yesterday. Possibly the most interesting day you could have thrown that conference, Sean. What did you and what did guests make of those comments?
Well, it was certainly a very strange day for all of us. On one level, Gulf Intelligence was celebrating its 10th birthday. It was our 10th UAE Energy Forum. And the backdrop couldn't have been more dramatic. You woke up in the morning to the news of great instability in the region. And really, by the end of the day, it was like nothing happened. The minister was obviously highlighting the vulnerability of the worst-case scenario, that the Straits of Hormuz could be closed. Of course, that's never happened, and would be a very rare event. But ultimately, it is, if all the worst dominoes were to fall, the supply coming out of the Gulf could be disrupted. And indeed, interestingly, yesterday, Saudi Aramco, the world's biggest oil exporting company, did stop its tankers from coming into the Gulf because of the uncertainty and the potential risks to shipping. So it is a very serious matter, but as the oil price reflects, a lot happened and then nothing happened in the end.
Exactly. We've got oil prices falling by around 5% today, coming well off what we saw yesterday. What was the atmosphere like at the forum, though? What was the general coffee break chat?
Well, there was a lot of, obviously, excitement, in a corporate sense, that happens at the beginning of each year. Our forum, the Gulf Intelligence UAE Energy Forum, is the first event of the year for the energy industry. It takes an outlook for the year ahead. And so consequently, the industry comes together with a sense of enthusiasm for what's coming. And I think in that regard, putting aside the events in the region, that this was there's a relatively positive mood in the industry. Oil prices have held solidly in the $65 or so range. Everybody's rather positive about that number. So I think generally the mood, in the industry is, and the OPEC Secretary General was also there, and his comments were, "We've seen it all before. This isn't our first rodeo. We're oil producers. We live with this level of instability for 50 years. This is nothing new. No panic." And that was generally the sentiment from the industry as a whole.
It's interesting, those comments from Mr. Al-Mazrui there about sort of no one wanting or being able to sustain $100 barrels of oil. And yet we have just come out of a year of cuts from OPEC. What is seen as a reasonable price, both for producers and consumers?
Well, I think if you look at the events of not just the last few days, but the last 6 months, we have witnessed, in the region, what you would consider is, out of the ordinary challenges to the oil industry, whether it be the shipping sector that was suffering or that got hit in the mid last year, or installations in Saudi Arabia that got disrupted. You know, there's been a lot of geopolitical turbulence in the last 6 months. And apart from momentary blips in the oil price when you would see an inevitable spike, the oil price has held pretty solidly in and around the kind of low to mid-60s. And generally, that seems to be the price, the fair balanced price at the moment in terms of where supply is at, where demand is at. We did a live survey yesterday with the 350 energy industry audience. And the consensus number that was voted on was mid-60s. So that seems to be the price that everybody's comfortable with. I think oil producers would like it to be a little bit higher, more 70, not higher from the cause of political instability or geopolitical risk, but higher because demand is strong. That's what oil producers want. Because $70 is really the number you need in order to get oil companies to invest in building more and more capacity. Because, of course, that's a very expensive exercise.
And very quickly, Sean, we've got the next OPEC Plus meeting in March. I can't imagine at the moment there's a lot we can forecast about it. But what could we see?
Well, the noise yesterday at the forum was very clear from the OPEC Secretary General and also from the UAE Minister that the OPEC Plus alliance of 20 countries that is participating in this output cut that's currently underway will sustain through the year. They're very committed to the OPEC Plus alliance, and all indicators are that that will continue beyond March and through the rest of the year.
Thanks very much for speaking to us. Sean Evers, founder and managing partner of Gulf Intelligence. We appreciate your time.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's pick of the papers.
Starting with a couple of millennials who have stood down from public duty, Brandy Scott. This is extraordinary. Who am I talking about?
You are talking about the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, but are they?
This is the Duchess of Sussex in her previous life.
Hi, I'm Rachel Zane. I'll be giving you your orientation.
Wow, you're pretty.
Good. You've hit on me. We can get it out of the way that I'm not interested.
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't hitting on you.
Trust me. I've given dozens of these, and without fail, whatever new hotshot it is thinks that because I'm just a paralegal, that I will somehow be blown away by his dazzling degree. Let me assure you, I won't.
Meghan Markle, as she was in Suits, the popular TV drama. Of course, she married Prince Harry, one of the heirs to the throne in the United Kingdom, and became obviously a very high profile figure because of that. But overnight, they have issued a statement saying that they are pulling back from royal life. I've got the statement in front of me. They say, after many months of reflection and internal discussions, we have chosen to make a transition this year in starting to carve out a progressive new role within this institution. We intend to step back as, quote, senior members of the royal family and work to become financially independent while continuing to fully support Her Majesty the Queen. What do we make of this? Producer Shruti, you're in the studio. I'm British, so clearly this is a big story for me. And I was umming and ahhing this morning. Is this a big international story, or is it just a posh British story for the UK elite?
Well, I would say now it is a big story because everyone watches The Crown, which is on Netflix, a popular series.
Suddenly the British royal family is popular.
Yes. So if you're, you know, on Netflix and you've watched The Crown, you are interested in what's happening. And I think it's sort of breaking the mold, isn't it?
And if you grew up in a Commonwealth country, I think you were anyway. We had Charles and Di coffee mugs. I think they probably outlasted the wedding. And for the rest of the world as well, I mean, you could argue, and people do, and it's one of the arguments for the funding, actually, of the royal family in the UK, is that they are effectively an asset to the UK from a tourism and a branding point of view. And we're talking quite a lot about branding on the show this morning. That one of the justifications for the public money that go towards the royal family is that it's, you know, one of the reasons that people come and visit the UK.
So Prince Harry and the Meghan Markle, as we'll call them now, Harry and Meghan, if they're pulling back from royal duties.
They're not pulling back completely, though. This is the point. I mean, I'm not a royalist, for starters. I'm gonna put that out there straight off. But regardless, I'm not sure this is how you quit your job.
So they just issued a statement in public.
Apparently, if you believe the Daily Mail, they were in early stages of discussing the possibility of seeking out, as the Mail puts it, a new life a week ago, and that family members had agreed to work with them. So it had been raised okay. over dinner. Mum, I don't think I want to go into the family
Christmas
business.
Lunch.
Yeah.
Harry and Meghan drop a bombshell and ruin everything.
Although not Christmas lunch.
Yeah, they were in Canada anyway. So maybe not. Maybe it was an email.
Exactly. So it had been raised. But according to those supposedly in the know, this has come as a huge shock. And I think that the statement that has come back from Buckingham Palace, which is two lines long, that just says, discussions with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex are at an early stage. We understand their desire to take a different approach, but these are complicated issues that will take time to work through, suggests that not everybody was on the same page.
Well, let me give you the Daily Mail, which is the unofficial but almost official mouthpiece of the British establishment. And it says this: the Queen's fury as Harry and Meghan quit. Royal couple did not tell Her Majesty, Prince Charles or William, who all learned of their decision to step back from the, capital letters, television, as aides complain about being, quote, stabbed in the back.
Do we think that this is actually a deal with Netflix? And that Netflix have said, where have we got it? Who's finished season three? Where did we get up to at the end of season three?
No, I'm still finishing season two.
Oh.
Because...
Suits or The Crown?
The Crown.
The Crown.
Fine. Mm.
Because there is a distinct possibility that they're thinking, right, okay, future episodes, we've got the Andrew stuff to go through, that's going to fill a couple of episodes, that'll be interesting. And then Harry and Meghan have said, let us help you out.
Who's going to play Meghan Markle? Do we know an actress?
Meghan Markle will play Meghan Markle.
From a job point of view, though, let's pull this into the business sphere. Is this how you quit a job?
No.
I mean, I'm all for a bombshell. I like a bit of drama.
No, most people are saying that, fair enough, if you decide to do this. But the royal family is known by the royal family as, quote, the firm, because it is a family business. I mean, they recognise that, away from all the pomp and circumstance, as Brandy said, their job is to fill hotel rooms in London. Their job is to get trade deals done by the United Kingdom in the UAE and countries like that. It's a branding exercise. Really, now, that's how you justify the expense of it. And therefore, it is the firm. They have a job to do, and it needs to be done, and done well. And scandal is not well-liked within the firm. They've had the shenanigans with Prince Andrew over the past... I say shenanigans, I mean, that's disrespectful to some of the women who've been caught up in this, but they've had the situation with Prince Andrew over the past month, and that's been a real blow. And then this. When they had, you know, they were, these two were the... You know, if you look at the firm as a business, is okay, succession planning in terms of who are going to be the high-profile standard bearers for the British royal family. Prince William and Kate are nice, but, you know, bland.
But that's... Yeah.
This is the new generation who are charismatic, good-looking, people
are interested
in them, got a bit of colour. You know, Harry's had his military career, Meghan's had her acting career.
Prince William can fly a rescue helicopter.
That is true. That is true. But these two were the box office of the royal family, weren't they?
Before anyone complains that we are going off-piste as a business breakfast, let me explain to you how about the finances work. Because you've got something called the Crown Estate. Pop quiz, who has one of the largest private art collections in the UK?
I would say it would be Her Majesty the Queen.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff in there. The Crown Estate, there's land, there's all the rest of it. You've got Prince Charles has got his own hummus line. I mean, there's stuff going on there.
Hummus line?
He totally does. It's in Waitrose. You can get it in Spinney's here.
Oh, wow, okay.
Other hummus is available. So that all makes money and profits. Mm. I don't know quite where the hummus fits into that, but there is stuff that generates a lot of profits. Those profits are actually paid to the Treasury. So it's not, and many people believe that, you know, oh, the taxpayer gives the money, the taxpayer did up Frogmore Cottage, blah, 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 blah. Not quite that simple. It's not just a case of the taxpayer just, the you know, gives money to the Treasury and they give it to the royal family, because the royal family actually generated quite a lot of income from their assets themselves, and whether or not they should have had those assets in the first place is a history debate that I'm not going to get into, that are paid to the Treasury. The Treasury actually then calculates a percentage 15 to 25%, that then is paid through a sovereign grant to the Crown, which is the taxpayer money that people refer to. Now, there is other taxpayer money that they absolutely certainly get that, as I understand it, is distinct. You have a lot of protection detail, for example, in the same way that you do for politicians. Mm. And where money from weddings comes from, the doing up of various cottages, I'm not quite sure how that fits into the purse. But I'm just pointing out that it's not a one-way street. They are revenue-generating as well as they are revenue-taking, if you like. Also, it seems, and I didn't realise this, that there is a cap on the royal family earning their own cash, because apparently this was one of the issues, that they felt that they couldn't make their own money from appearances and things. So I'm pretty sure you do.
Appearances. I thought you get paid. I mean, Prince Harry, Prince William got paid for being in the army, as they would, like, as anyone who would work in the army would get paid.
I, for some reason, I feel that the argument of not being able to earn your own money as senior royals, that you have to give up various income in order to receive that sovereign grant, I believed was an issue. Thanks for listening. Rich and myself will be back Sunday morning at 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.